This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of the very best arts and culture stories from NPR. I'm Neda Ulibi, here with a new format and a reminder. You can, as always, subscribe at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, singer, rapper, and actress Queen Latifah speaks to young women with low self-esteem in a new book. Another rapper, Odyssey, describes a new theme in hip-hop, the suburbs. And a West Virginia town that's become a supportive center for up-and-coming playwrights. But first,
the Twilight movie is going to make a ton of money, even though it doesn't feature Hollywood's trend of the year, 3D. Studios are demanding that more and more live-action movies be shot in 3D. As NPR's Neda Ulibi reports, that means even the most experienced filmmakers are having to learn a whole new set of technical skills.
We're ready, Dave.
Okay, here we go. Ready? Action,
on a dimly lit soundstage at the Sony studio backlot, about 30 cinematographers and camera operators are practicing a kind of filmmaking most of them have never done before.
I was trying to, keep it on his chest there, but then have his head kind of pop off the screen.
This free 3-day boot camp is the brainchild of Buzz Hayes, who runs Sony's 3D Technology Center. He says 3D is not a trend.
It's been relegated to the gimmick bin for far too long. But for those of us who have been working in 3D for a while, we realize that there's a certain truth to a 3D image, that if it's treated well, you can actually really engage an audience in a way that you could never do in two dimensions.
He says, in the movie Beowulf, for example, characters become more three-dimensional as they rise in power. And there was that awesome dragon exploding out of a cave. But the boot camp begins with serious lectures.
So we have to use convergence to take the depth that we've decided upon with our interaxial control and slide it back into the display surface.
Convergence, interaxial, interocular. The cinematographers and camera people are gearheads game to master this technology, but they do have some reservations.
It's cumbersome. I'm sure we'll get used to it.
Camera assistant Jamie Fells is tiny, and she's not convinced the payoff of switching to a hulking 3D camera that looks like a small tank is worth it.
I personally don't care about seeing a 3D movie. I'm not a 14-year-old boy.
But Fells is about to make a movie that may appeal to one. Harold and Kumar in 3D. Before the shoot in Michigan, the film's entire camera crew is here at 3D boot camp.
The rig that we'll be using in Detroit is 140 pounds. Four people have to carry it.
This is a huge concern for cinematographers because we fought so long to get our cameras to a point where you could hide them in places, you could carry them, you could place them in objects where the cameras never went before.
That's Rodney Charters, the longtime cinematographer for TV's 24, a show he says would never have worked in 3D because the camera had to be nimble enough to follow the star.
We were with Kiefer the whole time because of the physicality of the camera, and that's all gone now.
Gone, thanks largely to one movie, Avatar. Before Avatar, the most cutting-edge 3D films were animated. Now everyone from Martin Scorsese to Werner Herzog is making live-action 3D. Avatar completely changed the ambitions of directors, studios, and eager young film students. Perry Hoberman teaches at USC's School of Cinematic Arts, where demand for 3D training has skyrocketed.
A year ago, it was mostly animation students, but now, especially since Avatar, the production students, who are much more interested in live action, are really gunning to go.
So have you added faculty to help meet the demand?
We haven't added faculty yet. We hope to.
It's hard, says Perry, to hire people to teach 3D when so few can actually do it.
I mean, there are a few people who are very, very experienced, but by and large, the industry doesn't have the kind of accumulative knowledge of making film after film after film after film.
And that is what Sony wants to change with its 3D boot camps. Buzz Hayes, the director of Sony's 3D Tech Center, says they're free for a reason.
The payback for us is eventually someone will either do a Sony picture or they'll work with Sony equipment or they'll buy a Sony Bravia. That's really the payback for us.
And as 3D televisions begin to hit the market, it's in Sony's best interest to ensure directors and cinematographers can produce content to fill them.
Focus is starting near, and as soon as Bagman gets up, it pushes far.
Right now, they're practicing with a scene where an actor steals a homeless guy's bag. Over and over, the same wordless scene gets shot and reshot. One time, everyone goes wild with approval. I assumed some fancy 3D tech trick had been pulled off with great skill, but no. Cinematographer Rodney Charter said what killed was the performance.
He kicked him in the guts and ran off. And said, the actors, it's always about the actors, and we're just about the actors, and we're just there to film what they do.
No matter how many dimensions, if it's not entertaining, no one will watch it. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
For 20 years, in the oldest town in West Virginia, new plays have had a home and a loyal audience. The Contemporary American Theater Festival at Shepherd University is a dream for the writers of those plays. Over the years, both up-and-coming playwrights and big names like Sam Shepard and Joyce Carol Oates have premiered works there. As NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports, that's in large part due to the festival's hard-working founder.
One of the plays at this year's Contemporary American Theater Festival is called Inanna, named for the goddess of sex and war. It was written by Michelle Lowe. An Iraqi curator leaves his country for London with four mysterious suitcases and his new wife from an arranged marriage.
That's the tablet.
I thought it would be bigger.
Yes, it's small, but it's intact. That's unusual.
And you say it's important?
It outlines the wars between the Assyrians and the Egyptians.
Inanna is about many things. It's about stolen art. It's a love story set in the context of war. Ed Herendeen says it's exactly the kind of play he looks for.
Here is a play where we're looking at Iraqi people in a positive light. These are not terrorists. They're not going to bomb anybody. These are people who love their culture and are desperate to preserve it in a time when they're being invaded by another country.
But the Americans...
We don't know what the Americans are planning. Things disappear in war. Objects in museums vanish.
You care so much for these objects. What about the people?
The objects are part of the people. They're the deepest, hidden, most secret part. They're the best part and the most important part to protect.
One critic called Inanna an international thriller. Ed Herendeen founded the Contemporary American Theater Festival, or CATF, 20 years ago in partnership with Shepherd University. That first season, they did three plays and sold about 2,000 tickets. Today, they do five professional plays and sell over 11,000 tickets. It's a big tourist draw. It helps that Shepherdstown is in the Shenandoah Valley. What's unusual about CATF is that Herendeen says he's never tempted to do a popular play in order to draw more people.
The audience we've developed really is expecting us to do new plays. So because we never veered from our mission right from year one, we are known for doing adventurous work.
Herendeen says on average he reads about 75 scripts a year. He also scopes out new plays other regional theaters are doing. He first saw a reading of Inanna 2 years ago at the Denver Center Theater Company. And this is something else about Herendeen. He doesn't suffer from what he refers to as world premiere-itis, because that can hurt living playwrights.
One of the things that I've learned over the years, especially working with writers, that it's very difficult to get the first production, but writers tell me it's even more difficult to get production number two. In other words, once your play has had its world premiere, lots of theaters don't want to do it because it's already done that. And then it's very, how does a play move on? How does a play have life beyond the world premiere?
That's a wonderful thing for a playwright to hear.
Inanna playwright Michelle Lowe.
A theater is really taking a chance on this, and this is an artistic director who's going to make it work.
This is not to say Ed Herendeen shies away from world premieres altogether. He says he, too, likes the buzz you get from being first. This year, CATF is doing two world premieres. One of them could almost be called a musical.
Good evening, humans of both sexes. Thank you for pressing play on whatever electromagnetic radiating device you own. Activating my voice and bringing me to life.
I can't tell you the excitement and the buzz and the fear that we have. It's good fear. Producing the Eel Wax Jesus 3D pop music show.
Got that? The Eel Wax Jesus 3D pop music show. This play is set in some kind of group home somewhere in the U.S., and everyone who lives there is addicted to a TV show called Eel Wax Jesus. It was co-written by Max Baker.
It's set slightly in the future where going outside is extremely dangerous because of the swine flu in the air or the monkey pox. You know, the air has been turned into toxic fumes. So everyone's stuck inside and they're fed this entertainment. But the entertainment systems are so advanced that it looks like the person is, it's like as real as I'm sitting here.
Whether you notice it immediately or later, listening to these songs from the Earwax Cheeses 3D pop music show will put you in a notably better mood than the one you were in before it began.
Max Baker and his co-writer Lee Sellers are also actors based in New York. Sellers has been playing Officer Krupke in West Side Story on Broadway for the past couple of years. He's a Shepherdstown regular, acting in plays at CATF for about 9 years. I asked him if he's surprised the festival has lasted for 2 decades, doing such edgy, unfamiliar work.
Yes and no. It does surprise me in, you know, the real world, the business world, how to do it. But then you meet Ed and you meet the people that he's surrounded himself with down here, the creative team, the artists and everything. And then it really doesn't surprise you because you're like, of course this is going well. You know, he just single-handedly refuses to let it fail.
But ask Ed Herendeen the same question, and he'll say it's because they have a great partnership with Shepherd University, that they've got an engaged board of directors, and that they're in a state, West Virginia, that's friendly to the arts. Herendeen doesn't get sentimental about the past.
The thing about theater people is we do a production, we spend all this time creating a play, and then we take the set down, we call it strike. We strike the set, and I'm already thinking about next season. So we're always looking to the future, you know, because theater's not permanent. You know, it lives in the moment, and I'm more interested in talking about the next 20 years in many ways.
In other words, there is still a lot of work to do. The 20th Contemporary American Theater Festival at Shepherd University runs for 3 weeks, beginning July 9th. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Whether you're listening to this for the very first time or you've heard it all before, this song will shortly end. And sadly, when it does, so my voice...
Figuring out what to make of research is never easy. And we have a story now that shows just how badly research can be misinterpreted. It's about the so-called Mozart effect, the idea that listening to Mozart can enhance your intelligence. NPR's Elise Spiegel talked to the woman who first researched that idea.
It all started with this sound. In the spring of 1993, psychologist Francis Rauscher played 10 minutes of a Mozart sonata for 36 college students, then gave them a test of their spatial reasoning. She also had the students take the test after listening to 10 minutes of silence and 10 minutes of a relaxing voice. And the results of this experiment, says Rauscher, seemed pretty clear.
What we found was that the students who had listened to the Mozart sonata scored significantly higher on the spatial-temporal task.
Now, Rauscher emphasizes that the test measured only a certain kind of spatial intelligence, and that's all.
It's very important to note that we did not find effects for general intelligence, just for this one aspect of intelligence. It's a small gain, and it doesn't last very long.
In fact, the so-called Mozart effect lasted only 10 to 15 minutes, which is what Rauscher wrote in the single-page paper that she subsequently published in the journal Nature. And personally, Rauscher didn't expect many people to be interested in this finding. Then came the call.
The first call came from Associated Press before I even knew the paper was coming out. And then, all of a sudden, once it broke in Associated Press, it was everywhere. I mean, we had people coming to our house and interviewing us for live television. I had to hire somebody to handle all the calls that were coming in.
Now, the headlines were less subtle than her findings. Mozart makes you smart was the idea. For some reason, this notion completely gripped the American imagination.
I mean, we walked into Virgin Records one day, and there was this whole kiosk of Mozart music and quotations from our paper.
And then, Rauscher says, things started to go south. For instance, she got misquoted by a TV program, which made her seem like she was saying rock music wasn't cognitively good.
When that happened, I started getting phone calls, literally death threats, from people that were so offended that I would say that rock music was bad for the brain, so I had to get an unlisted number. It was crazy.
But worse, Rauscher says, was that her very modest finding started to really be wildly distorted.
Somehow or other, the myth started exploding that children that listen to classical music from a young age will do better on the SAT, they'll score better on intelligence tests in general and so forth.
In fact, after hearing about the research, in 1998, Georgia's then governor, Zell Miller, decided to distribute free classical music CDs to every baby born in the state of Georgia. Tennessee did the same. And eventually, a small cottage industry of Mozart CDs for toddlers and babies sprung up. So why is it that all of this came from such a modest study? Rauscher thinks it's probably a couple of things. Americans believe in self-improvement, but also quick fixes. And she says parents care desperately about their children.
I mean, they want to do everything they possibly can for their children. And if there's the possibility that this might help in some way, that's what they're going to do.
Now, Rauscher still stands by her original finding, but says subsequent research shows it's not really about Mozart. Any music that you find engaging will do the same, basically because it stimulates you.
I think the key to it is you have to enjoy the music. If you love Pearl Jam, you're going to find the Pearl Jam effect.
Britney Spears?
I don't know. Maybe.
The Christina Aguilera effect.
I like the Ella Fitzgerald effect.
And with that in mind, here's something to make all you public radio listeners much smarter for the next 10 minutes. Brittany, take us out. Elise Spiegel, NPR News, Washington.
Superstar Queen Latifah spends a fair amount of time on the red carpet, but the actor, rapper, singer, and model is also Dana Owens, the gangly kid who grew up in Newark who's made her share of mistakes. Now she hopes to use her celebrity and her example to address what she sees as an epidemic of lousy self-esteem among young women and girls that contributes to violent relationships, to substance abuse, financial mismanagement, and all kinds of other problems. Her message, if I did it, so can you. Queen Latifah's new book is Put on Your Crown, Life-Changing Moments on the Path to Queendom. And she joins us from our studios at NPR West. And nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I know that during the BET Awards, at every interval, you changed into a different costume, one of the ones you wore at in different movies and different TV shows. That must have been quite a trip through memory lane.
It felt like, felt like Saturday Night Live in one way. But it was a lot of fun to kind of touch bases on all these characters that I've played through the years, including, you know, my own identity as a female rapper, mm-hmm. as, you know, Cleo from Set It Off, and then to finally get to a place where I could just be glamorous. It was wonderful. I was like, okay, enough of these costumes. Can I just be a pretty girl? Thank you.
There you go.
That's great.
The costume, though, from Chicago, you had to have that taken in, I bet.
I did. It was fun. I mean, I got to be, you know, Matron Mama Morton and be Maybelle from Hairspray. It was a blast. It was hectic. It was crazy. It was fun. It was all very, like, last minute. But, you know, I think I was able to kind of bring my identity to that show, which I thought was a lot of fun.
It's interesting in reading your book, you write about how playing some of those characters, well, those were some of the moments that changed your life. They were people that you connected with and learned a lot from.
Absolutely. And also, you know, you have to deal with a lot of yourself when you, you know, just to be an actor, you have to be in touch with your emotions because, you know, whatever your, you know, character has to go through, you have to be able to deliver. And if you can't touch those emotions in your own personal life, it's kind of hard to bring them across to your character. So, I mean, I remember, I remember shooting Set It Off, and I remember there was a scene where I had to cry and, you know, I'd lost my brother. And so my emotions were very numb at some point, you know, and I literally had to go into it and deal with those emotions in order to even be able to pull those scenes off. So, you know, it really kind of forces you to look at yourself to be an actress.
There are moments that you're very candid about a lot of these moments in your life. And it must have been difficult for you to write about the episode where you went broke.
It was, in a way. It was, a little uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But believe me, I've heard these stories from people who are much more successful than I am. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
So it wasn't, you know, something that was unheard of. And I think especially with our economic times, people go through these things. And I think the thing to remember, what I thought was the best thing to recognize, was that it doesn't matter what level, economic level you're on. I mean, Donald Trump, you know, filed bankruptcy years ago. I mean, he bounced back. There's a lot of people on a lot of levels who go through difficult times, and you just have to figure out how to bounce back from those situations and learn from them. So for me, it was about really learning how to, you know, restructure my business and to pay more attention to it, to not leave it in other people's hands. You work really hard to earn this money, but are you taking care of it? So, and oddly enough, after I reorganized that whole situation, God just blessed me with so much more. I mean, I became much more, you know, wealthy after that happened. And it was almost like he wanted me to, you know, get it together so he could bless me more. But don't ruin, you know, don't mess it up again. Get your act together, kid. That's kind of what he was saying. I felt that's kind of what I took from it. So
you've got more, but now you know where it is.
Exactly.
a lesson that you learned that doesn't actually apply to most of us is to sign all your own checks. Nobody
sign
to.
All of your own checks. Absolutely.
There are lessons that people will say, you know, wait a minute, managing a you know, multi-million-dollar business, that doesn't really apply to my life. You know, the kinds of well, you talk about managing your own body weight and saying, well, that's great, I can get a personal trainer. Ha.
Well, you don't even need a personal trainer necessarily. It's really about, you know, just paying attention to your body, you know, listening to your body, looking at, you know, how you feel about it. Are you drinking enough water? Are you eating the right kinds of foods? You know, sometimes, I mean, if we really listen to our bodies, they kind of tell us what we need. For some reason, you might crave a banana. You might need some potassium. I mean, this, you know, you might need to eat a little more meat. Maybe your body needs some more iron or some spinach. Or, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. If we listen to it, I think our bodies kind of tell us what we need to be doing. And, of course, we obviously need to exercise more. And, you know, I'm not the, you know, I'm not the coach of telling everyone what to do with their bodies. But I know my body responds like that. When I'm working too hard, when I'm not eating enough, I seem to lose weight, and it's not the kind of weight that I want to lose, you know. And it's I like to be healthy. I don't mind if I'm thicker or heavier, or as long as I feel good, as I feel strong, I feel, you know, like I have the right nutrition, I'm good to go, you know. It's I don't really look at myself like, okay, I have to look a certain way, be a certain weight, jump on the scale all the time. That's really not how I judge myself. But I know if I don't feel well, it's because something is not, I'm not doing something properly for my body. So I just try to make sure I eat better or exercise a little more. And I think that's, you just have to listen to your own body.
We're talking with Queen Latifah about...
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia.
The Brookings Institution released a report last month that showed for the first time in American history, most ethnic minorities live in suburbs, and it coincided with something that's been happening in hip-hop and rap. MCs that aren't talking about the streets of the city, but the strip malls of the suburbs, places like Prince George's County in Maryland.
I'm from PG, I rap DMV, I step easily, know who's seeing me, none. You got a problem, bring it on, you know that I'm a solver, sing along. Yeah, cause I'm from PG, I rap DMV, I step easily, know who's seeing me, none.
All the music you'll hear in this story, including this track called I'm from PG, was produced, recorded, and written by a rapper named Amir Muhammad El Khalifa, who calls himself Odyssey.
When I was younger, I read The Odyssey and Iliad by Homer, and so I wanted my music to take people on journeys beyond just where they're from to another place. That's where the name really came from, just wanting my music to be a journey for people.
Odyssey grew up in Prince George's County, Maryland, that's just outside Washington, D.C. It's the wealthiest majority African-American county in the country. There was a time, not so long ago, when a rapper wasn't considered legitimate unless he spoke about life in the city.
I think we're coming into an age where people were coming out and admitting that they're from the suburbs because they've been from the suburbs. Kanye is from the suburbs. Pharrell is from the suburbs. these are the people who are dominating the music industry right now. These are the reason why jeans are tighter in the hood, because these are the reason why kids are on skateboards in the hood now. It's the transformation has been underway for a long time now.
A transformation that's inspired a whole new crop of hip-hop artists who are returning to the earlier roots of rap. East Coast hip-hop that was once dominated by MCs like Eric B. and Rakim, De La Soul, and A Tribe Called Quest. Music that spoke to rappers like Odyssey.
It just related to where I came from. They didn't talk about crack, drugs, killing, murder.
The hood.
Nah, they didn't. And it made sense to me.
And yet you wouldn't call the music Odyssey makes necessarily safe or vapid. He tackles subjects ranging from boredom to false bravado to the dramatic inequality he witnessed as a kid living in a comfortable place where almost everyone he knew was black.
When you grow up with opportunity, yet poverty and drastic differences in your lifestyle are so close and the proximity is so close to one another, it directly affects the type of music you listen to and the type of music you make.
Prince George's County straddles the border of some of the roughest parts of Washington, D.C. And while the county might also be home to some of the wealthiest African Americans in the country, it was also a place where 92 people were murdered last year.
The urban issues made their way to the suburbs the same day that blacks who could afford to move out of D.C. to escape D.C. in the 80s, the day they moved, the issues came with them.
Odyssey is part of a loose collective of rappers, producers, and R&B singers who identify with a regional sound known as DMV. DMV for the District, Maryland, and Virginia.
D.C. sits in the middle of the East Coast. We're not quite Southern and we're not quite Northern. We're a direct amalgamation of Northern and Southern culture, and that has given our music an identity. It's East Coast rap with a Southern twang.
It's a sound that's rooted in a particular kind of funk that was created in Washington. It's called go-go. And so, unlike hip-hop trends in other parts of the country, the DMV sound is less about sampling and more about creating original music with swinging percussion and identifiable rhythms.
We are really accustomed to live instrumentation because of go-go music, which originated from funk. And that's something that really makes us different from lots of other scenes of hip-hop around the country.
This track is called The Party Roll by D.C. jazz guitarist Chuck Brown. He's considered the godfather of go-go.
D.C. is really a unique American city because it's one of the few predominantly black cities where hip-hop never really took a hold.
That's Andrew Nas. He's a hip-hop blogger who writes at cbrap.com.
D.C.'s always been a go-go city, which is a style of music that's derived from funk and kind of conga-driven. It's live music. It's not rapping over records.
Now, as much as Odyssey is Washington, D.C., PG County, the DMV, he's also on his way up as a producer. He was recognized pretty early on by the hit-making DJ Peter Rosenberg, who has a show on the influential New York station Hot 97. And so even with the DMV ethic flowing through his sound, Odyssey is leaving this city in the coming months and headed to New York.
D.C. and DMV is an amazing place to create music, but there's no industry here.
He's already had contacts with some of the biggest names in hip-hop, like Kanye West and The Roots. And while he wished it were different, it won't be the strip malls of the D.C. suburbs that will make Odyssey a star, but rather the streets of the city, New York. If you'd like to hear more music by Odyssey, check out our website, npr.org.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening, and so long.